This is the WGBH Forum Network.
Our first lecture in our series today is entitled Ponzi Scheme, The True Story of a Financial Legend. And this is the beautiful book that we're going to be hearing about today, which we will be selling after the lecture. I want to introduce our speaker, Mitchell Zuckoff, who is a professor of journalism at Boston University, where he is co-director of the BU Narrative and Investigative Reporting Program. He is the author of Choosing Naya, a Boston Globe bestseller and winner of the Christopher Award, and co-author of Judgment Ridge, which was a finalist for an Edgar Award. As a reporter with the Boston Globe, he was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize and won the 2000 Distinguished Writing Award from the American Society of Newspaper Editors, among other national honors. So please help me welcome today Mitchell Zuckoff. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Michelle, and thank you for coming. First, let me just say it's an honor to be here. The Old South Meeting House is truly a temple to free speech. And as a journalism professor and as a journalist, this is one of the great places of America in my mind. I'm going to talk today about Ponzi scheme. And a lot of people know the word, the phrase, Ponzi scheme, but they don't know about the man behind the scheme. I mean, most of the time when your name gets attached to something, you want it to be something wonderful. You want it to be like the Salk vaccine, not like the Ponzi scheme. If something attaches your name to a scheme, it's not necessarily a good thing, not something you go out seeking. And Ponzi certainly did not go out seeking this. I got interested in the Ponzi scheme while I was a business reporter at the Boston Globe. It was around 1990, and banks were failing in Boston, left and right, Bank of New England, for those of you who remember, and many others. Every Friday, you know, Wednesday was Prince Spaghetti Day, and Friday was Bank Failure Day. And what we had was, and one day somebody mentioned to me, you know, banks and the financial world of Boston hasn't had this much turmoil since the days of Ponzi. And I was embarrassed to admit, and this is about 16 years ago, 15 years ago, I had heard of Ponzi, I knew what the Ponzi scheme was in general, but I had no idea that he had actually operated from right here in downtown Boston. This phrase that had become part of the lexicon had started right here, and as a banking reporter, as a business reporter, that immediately fascinated me. And so I always sort of kept an eye on it, kept collecting string, and thinking someday I'm going to write a book about this. And then when we had the Enron scandal and the WorldCom scandal and all these different things happening, I figured if ever there's a time to tell the world about the granddaddy of them all, now's the time. So that's the origin of the story. Before I start talking specifically about Ponzi, I just want to take a second to make sure everybody knows what a Ponzi scheme is in the current lexicon. And a lot of people confuse it with a pyramid scheme. Pyramid scheme is built on the idea of a network, the idea that one person recruits another 10 people, for instance, who recruit 10 people, and it's ultimately unsustainable. It's a financial operation that's unsustainable because if you get to about 10 layers down, and you need 10 billion people to support the pyramid. Because we only have about 5 or 6 billion on the planet, that makes it really difficult. And then it ultimately collapses. A Ponzi scheme is different, and what's fascinating to me about a Ponzi scheme is really about one person. It's about one, almost always tremendously charismatic, tremendously interesting, always individual who convinces people by dint of his own charm, charisma, his own confidence, because they ultimately are confidence men, that you can trust them with any amount of money, and he will return it to you, usually it's a man, with a tremendous, exorbitant interest rate in a short period of time. In Ponzi's case, double your money in 3 months. And basically, it's the old game of robbing Peter to pay Paul. Ponzi is not taking that money and having some wild, fantastic investment opportunity, really. He's taking that money and putting it in one pocket, and then when another investor comes in the next day, he takes that money and puts it in the pocket. And if the first investor comes back, he pays the investor out of the money from later investors. It's just a churning wheel, basically, of early investors paid with money from later investors. And the whole idea of a Ponzi scheme as it's operated is that ultimately you'll gather enough money together, you'll have a huge critical mass of money, and you skip town. It's a take the money and run operation. It's really what a Ponzi scheme is designed to be. Well, what I think you'll learn today is that Charles Ponzi, whose name has been attached to this scheme, really never intended to do any of that. And in fact, had a very legitimate idea that was at the very basis of his plan, of the thing that made him, at the moment in 1920, one of the most famous men in the world. Before we talk about Ponzi, let me just take a minute about the era, because I think you can't really understand Ponzi without understanding the world in which he lived. 1920 was a remarkable time in America, a time of true change happening. I think it's fair to call it the dawn of modern America. You have the end of the Great War, the end of World War I, and people sort of saying, okay, we suffered through the deprivation of war, now it's time to get rich, now it's time to have fun. The flapper age, the golden age, the roaring 20s are just getting kicked off. Prohibition is in effect, but Prohibition, people who've studied Prohibition will tell you, had an unintended effect on the American people. Instead of creating increasing morality, what Prohibition actually did was it made it okay to break the law in people's minds. It actually had the opposite effect of intended. It undermined the values of Americans who were normally law-abiding citizens. Because everybody flouted, not everyone, but people, it was so widely flouted, Prohibition, that people started saying, well, you know, laws, not every law is equal to every other law. And it actually had an undermining effect on the country. The stock market's revving up. You have immigration, a boom of immigration, leading to people worried about immigrant groups, particularly in cities like Boston and New York, where you had Italians and other immigrants being rounded up as anarchists. You had a bit of chaos going on. For the first time in American history, more people are living in cities than out in the rural countryside. You have cities booming. So a lot of things happening, women getting the right to vote, etc. But the bottom line, and it really is my bottom line, is it's a time when money becomes a driving force in American life, more so than at any other time in American history. And into that world steps my man, Charles Ponzi, an Italian immigrant born in 1882 in Lugo, Italy. His family was rich in name, but nothing else. I went to Italy and did genealogical research on him, and it turns out all of his mother's relatives had the honorific Don or Donna before their name, which linked them to the Duchy of Parma. So they were all linked aristocratically to the finest people of northern Italy. But by the time Ponzi was born, the family's wealth had been squandered or lost, and they were relatively poor. His father was working as a postman when he was born. But his mother, Imelda Ponzi, spent all of his childhood spinning, as he called it, castles in the air. That he was going to be the one who restored the Ponzi name, this family, to greatness. And that was a very, very important part of his character development. He comes to America in 1903 because he washes out of the University of Rome. The aristocratic stuff went to his head a little bit. And instead of studying, he fell in with a group of aristocrats, young aristocrats, and gambled and drank his nights away. So his family says, go to America. There's gold in those streets there. He really heard that phrase from his uncle when they put him on a ship. And he comes here. He actually lands in Boston in 1903. And he lands in Boston and finds, of course, the streets are paved with mud. And he has to go chasing his fortune somewhere else. He travels up and down the East Coast trying everything to become rich because he believes he is going to be the one who returns to Italy with just piles of money and he's going to fulfill his dreams and his mother's dreams. Well, he ends up in Montreal, gets caught up in a scheme up there where a banker named Luigi Zarossi is running basically a robbing Peter to pay Paul scheme. He's promising exorbitant returns on deposits to try and increase the size of his bank. And instead, of course, the bank collapses. Ponzi, on the way out, makes a terrible mistake. Ponzi passes a bad check. He forges a check to have some traveling money. It was a terrible mistake, and he paid for it. They catch him almost immediately, send him to prison for more than 2 years for forging a check. He gets out, helps some other fellow Italians try to go back from Canada to the United States, gets caught again. instantly, like within days. And, you know, if he has any luck, it's bad luck. And he gets sent to prison again, this time down in Atlanta, federal penitentiary down in Atlanta. He gets out, and you'd think he'd be hardened or embittered by this, but he was a truly irrepressible guy. And we're talking about a guy who stood all of about 5'1". He claimed 5'2", but he was prone to exaggeration. But best I can tell, he was 5'1". He goes to a small mining town in Blockton, Alabama, and he comes up with a brilliant idea. He's going to start a utility company. He's going to launch a company to provide water and power to all these little mining towns spread throughout these valleys. It was brilliant, and it actually probably would work. He was going to sell stock in the company, and he was going to be the great provider of light and power and heat. But just before he put it into operation, he was working as a male nurse, doing a variety of different things just to make ends meet. He ran into a doctor he knew who said, I've got a tragedy. And they're having a beer, and I've got a tragedy to tell you about. Pearl Gossett, another nurse in the mining camp, had been horribly burned in a kerosene explosion. And Ponzi said, well, why can't you help her? He said, well, I need a skin. I need to give her skin graft, or she'll lose her arm and maybe her life. And Ponzi said, well, how much do you need? He goes, a lot. Ponzi said, take all you need. He barely knew this woman, but Ponzi donated 220-odd square inches of skin from the back and the back of his legs. He would be scarred the rest of his life for this incredibly generous, heroic act, one for which the community rallied around him and nominated him for a National Heroism Prize. Now, in the meantime, it made him terribly sick. He suffered from pleurisy, from pneumonia, and by the time he recovered from this generous act, somebody else had taken his idea for a utility company, and he was again out of luck, still broke. Heads back to Boston. In Boston, things start to change when he comes back to Boston in 1917. The first thing that happens of real note is he meets Rose. Rose Ginecco is the Italian-American daughter of a fruit merchant down here, downtown, near Faneuil Hall. And he falls madly in love with her. She's much younger. She's about 17 years younger than he is. And she's beautiful, I think you can tell. And what's interesting about Rose is that she only wanted Ponzi. She wanted just a happy home with children and maybe a small house with a picket fence. But he transferred onto her all of his dreams of great wealth. He wanted her to be draped in furs and dripping in diamonds. He wanted her to be living in the castle in the air that his mother had built for him in his mind. So he tried everything to get rich. He actually even took over his in-law's fruit business for a while, which was failing at the time. It wasn't his fault, but that didn't work. Forgive me, it was fruitless. But then one day he wrote to some people he knew. He was trying to come up with an idea for a trading magazine. And he wrote to some people that he knew in Europe. And one wrote back to him with one of these in the letter. And this is a remarkable little document. And I have one up here I'm happy to pass around if you'd like to take a look. This is called an international reply coupon. It is one of the only forms of international currency in the world. It has value in almost every country on the planet. And its only value, though, is to buy stamps. The son of a postman falls into his idea with a stamp coupon, basically. And what it is this. If you're living in America and your parents are living back in Italy, you would write them a letter and enclose one of these as a way to say, Mama, please tell me about the village. You know, write back to me quickly. Because if you enclosed a dollar or a coin, they would have to transfer that into lira and then go to the post office. This was a polite way of saying, here's a stamp self-addressed envelope. When you bring your letter to the post office, bring this, it will get you a stamp. Now remember, I mentioned World War I. After World War I, the world currencies were horribly depressed. European countries especially had their currencies dropped in value tremendously. But the Universal Postage Union, which is sort of a precursor in a way to the UN, it was one of the first international cooperative bodies, hadn't gotten around to revalue the value of an IRC. So it was possible if you could figure out a way to do it, you could go to Europe and buy a dollar's worth of these international reply coupons. And but you'd get so many for that American dollar's worth. If you brought them back here to the United States and turned them into money, you could have perhaps $5 or $10 or even $20 worth, because the Italian or the Bulgarian or the other European countries were so depressed. You'd get so much more for your dollar there. And if you could figure out how to turn it into money here, you could be richer than Rockefeller. Ponzi realized this sitting in a small office he had rented literally about 100 yards from here on School Street, 27 School Street. When you leave here, I hope you go by it. It's the Niles building. He was sitting in his little tiny office on the second floor, scheming up ideas, trying to get rich, when literally this document floated out of this paper and it changed his life completely. He said, all I need to do is get over to Europe with a ton of money, buy a ton of these, come back here and turn them into cash. Well, he said, okay, that's great. I'll go. And he goes around the corner right here on Washington Street to the Hanover Trust Company, and he walks into the bank president, Henry Chmielinski, and says, Mr. Chmielinski, I'd like to take out a loan. And Henry Chmielinski says, please get the hell out of here. Your deposits are, in fact, more trouble than they're worth, Mr. Ponzi. I'm certainly not going to give you a loan. And he tries this again and again. Same thing happens each time. Well, he asks some friends, and none of his friends. Friends are like him, struggling. They don't have money. So he makes a decision. I have no track record, so I will sell directly to the public. I'll go and ask people to invest with me, to trust me with their money, and I'll obviously have to offer a lot of returns, a great return, because why would they bank with me instead of with somebody more established? So he sets up the Securities Exchange Company. He's the original SEC. This is about 10 years before the Securities Act that created what we now know to be the great regulatory body for stock. Because he had no seed money, no access to financing, and no track record. And so he organizes this company. And it's hard to see in this light, but I love this, because Ponzi understood that he hadn't figured out the logistics here. He knew that he had a great idea that was actually legal and at least theoretically possible. But he knew it was kind of implausible. How would you get so many of these IRCs back here? How would you turn them into cash? He hadn't figured out the details. But he said, those will come. I'll figure that out in time. But he kind of knew that until I figure that out, maybe I should give myself a little bit of cover. So he incorporates by saying that with three names on his incorporation papers filed right over there at Boston City Hall, in fact, in 1920. He writes John Dondero as the president of the company. John Dondero was his wife's uncle and had no idea what was going on and knew nothing of this. But the better one is actually the second line, Guglielmo Bertolotti. Guglielmo Bertolotti was actually Ponzi's landlord back in Parma, Italy. And by Ponzi's calculation, Guglielmo Bertolotti would have been about 100 years old at this point and was most likely dead, which made him, of course, the perfect silent partner. And Ponzi puts himself third on the line, on the third line, just as manager of the company. Like, I don't really know what's going on. I'm just the manager. Please don't bother me if there's a problem. So he knew there was something fishy, but he hadn't figured it out yet. And he starts offering what become quickly known throughout Boston and soon throughout New England and then throughout the United States and beyond as a Ponzi note. People come rushing to get one of these. He offers any amount of money you invest with him. I will give you, first he says 50% in 90 days, which is a fantastic return. Then things are going so well, he says 50% in 45 days. I will double your money in 90 days for every dollar you give me. Well, you know, as I say, too good to miss, Trump's too good to be true. And anyone who is saying, well, that sounds too good to be true, maybe they didn't invest. But most people around Boston seem to want to get one of these notes in their hands. This note belonged to Principio Santososo, who was a Boston Post reporter who bought it in June of 1920 for $200. He was supporting his wife and his spinster aunts in living in the North End. And Principio, interestingly, didn't write a word about this in the Boston Post. He just walked, the Boston Post office was here on Washington Street. He just walked over to School Street, bought one of these, and not a word appeared in the press about Ponzi for more than a month after Principio bought that document. Well, This was the scene inside School Street. People would be coming up and going to what would look like faux teller windows, people from all walks of life in Boston, and this is actually from inside the that office. And they brought friends. This is Pie Alley, right around the corner from here. They crowded Pie Alley, literally shoulder to shoulder, 10, 12 deep some days, especially when things got really busy. And you can see from the first month where he really, this only existed for about 8 months. From the first month of really taking investments, he starts at $1,700 or so. And by June, he takes in $2.5 million. He's opened up offices all across New England. People are calling him saying, can I be your agent in Lowell? Can I be your agent in Providence or Connecticut? And he says, sure. The money's coming in, you know, just give him these Ponzi notes, you know, just give him an SEC note. And people kept flocking in because when the 90 days came around, Ponzi was happy to pay them. He hadn't figured out how he was going to do it exactly with the IRCs, so he started robbing Peter to pay Paul. He started using the money from later investors to pay the early investors whose money, whose notes came due. But what often happened was, as soon as Ponzi said, if Principio Santo Soso said, yeah, I want my $300, I want my 50% in 45 days, I want to double my money, Ponzi said, of course, here it is. And Santo Soso, like so many other people, would say, if I wait another 45 days, I'll have double that, or another 90 days, I'll double that. So very few of them actually took their money out. They reinvested. They said, wow, he's legitimate. He's here, and in fact, he was sort of ingenious about it. He even did things like, he had a 19-year-old bookkeeper, Lucy Melly, working for him, and a few days before everyone's note came due, she would send the postcard, please come get your money. And people couldn't believe it. He was begging them to come take their 50% or 100% interest. It made him the most credible man in the world to these people. He must be on the level. He wants us to come get his money. And what's interesting to me about Ponzi is right around this time, he could have taken the money and run. There was no extradition treaty with Italy. He was still an Italian immigrant. He was still an Italian citizen. And around this time, in late June 1920, he was walking around with a suit coat around the streets of Boston, always incredibly dapper, very charming, great dresser, great looking guy. And in one pocket of the suit coat, he had a certificate of deposit for more than $1 million made out to him. And in the other front pocket, he had two first-class tickets to Italy for himself and Rose for the long-awaited honeymoon he had wanted for her that they could never afford. But he realized if he took this trip at this time with all this money coming in, people would think he had taken the money and run. But instead, he took those two tickets and cashed them in and bought a ticket instead for his mother, Imelda Ponzi, who he hadn't seen in 17 years, brings her over from the old country, sets her up in this gorgeous house that he buys in Lexington. The house is still there on Slocum Road, and this is Imelda Ponzi with Rose and Ponzi there at the house. There was no end run in this guy. He was sure. He had such tremendous confidence, maybe call it deluded confidence, that he would figure out a way to turn this cash, this idea into cash. He had such a brilliant idea, and it was possible, but improbable, but he would figure some other way because things were finally coming together for him. He was able to give Rose everything he wanted for her. He bought the most splendid car of its age, the Locomobile, which was like the ultimate, better than the Rolls Royce, frankly, in its age. And everything seemed to be going just fine. But then, and there's always a but then, isn't there? Richard Grozier was the young editor and publisher of the Boston Post. He was the son of Edwin Atkins Grozier, who was the real genius of the Boston Post, which was, in its time, the greatest newspaper of Boston of the age. But interestingly, again, I didn't set these props up, Edwin Atkins Grozier had a terrible stroke, had a completely debilitating stroke in March of 1920 because he tangled with that man back there. James Michael Curley. James Michael Curley and Edwin Atkins Grozier were going at it left and right, back and forth, publicly going after each other, and Edwin Atkins Grozier, who was never in great health, had a complete collapse. And suddenly the paper falls to his son, Richard Grozier. And Richard Grozier had basically been just like Ponzi, where Ponzi had washed out of the University of Rome, Richard Grozier basically tried very, very hard to wash out of Harvard. He kept the Harvard's file on Richard Grosier is about that thick. From all the letters the deans were writing to his father, please take your son home. Please, he's not working out. And Edwin Atkins Grosier, repeatedly, always writing under the letterhead of the Boston Post, so lest there be no mistake, this is the son of the most powerful newspaper editor in your town, was really the implicit message, would say, please give him one more chance, and they always would. But Richard, in the 10 years since he had graduated from Harvard, had never proven himself, had basically been like Ponzi, only he had the advantage of having a father who owned the newspaper. So he'd had a very sort of undistinguished 10-year career at the paper, bouncing from one job to another. But now was his moment. In the summer of 1920, he became convinced, when all the other newspapers were silent, or in a couple cases, even supporting Ponzi, and saying, this man is the Midas touch. This man is you know, the man who's going to make every man in Boston wealthy. Richard Grosier said, no, I'm going to go after him because it can't be true. It can't possibly be true. He sends out one of his young reporters and comes back with this story. The first story appears July 20th, 1920, and it's this story. And at first, it's a classic piece of journalism. It doesn't take any shots at Ponzi. It simply explains to the world what Ponzi is claiming. It tells the story of what Ponzi is doing and what Ponzi says he's doing, goes out to the house in Lexington and describes it, and it looks, that first day, like the Post is on Ponzi's side. In part because just of how the story is played. If you look right below the story, you see that, okay, you have a choice, dear reader of the Boston Post. You can go with this guy who says 50% interest in 45 days, or you can invest your money, thank you, in the bank, put the money in the bank, for 5% a year. More people than ever came to Ponzi the day this story appeared. And the Post was obviously inflamed by that and enraged by that. So they kept on him day after day, going after Ponzi, demonstrating what he's claiming can't possibly be true. And they brought in political cartoons against him, and every day they start pounding him. The other papers get on board too, but they let the Post take the lead. They say the Post is going to lose its presses. Ponzi's going to own the Post if they're wrong, because he will get them for libel. And Ponzi was claiming that he would sue them for $5 million and more. Well, once the Post came on board with him, the regulators who had ignored Ponzi said, maybe we should look at this guy. So you had the bank commissioner, you had the Attorney General of Massachusetts, you had the U.S. District Attorney, the Federal Attorney, and also the Suffolk District Attorney, all come after Ponzi at once. And really, they were being led in many ways, not only by Richard Grosier, but by Clarence Barron, the owner of the Wall Street Journal and the man who owned Barron's Financial, was the greatest financial journalist of his age, who was claiming that Ponzi couldn't possibly be doing what he was doing. But Ponzi stayed cool. Every day they came after him, more and more people came demanding their money, and there soon was a run on Ponzi's operation. Thousands of people were lining up in School Street and along Washington Street asking for their money back, saying they were afraid. And Ponzi was happy to pay them back. He said, of course I'll give you, I can't give you your interest because you haven't waited the 45 days. But he thought if he could sustain this run, if he could somehow survive the run on him, he would still have enough money to turn it into something wonderful. And he had another idea. He was going to buy all the ships that had been mothballed by the U.S. Shipping Board after World War I. He was on the verge of making a multi-million dollar offer for all these ships to set up the biggest import-export company in the world. If he just had enough time, he thought he would be able to, because frankly, at this point, tons of people wanted to invest with him. If he had set up the Ponzi company and sold stock in it, he could have collected tens, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars, because his name was on everyone's lips. And if he could sustain, if he could fight off this run, he would be possibly able to pull it out. Remember, a lot of great fortunes were made on the backs of not-so-legitimate operations. How many people know, obviously the Kennedy fortune grew out of Prohibition. And a lot of stock deals that now would, frankly, be illegal. So that was the time in which he was living, and he thought, this is my moment. So each day, he has to pay back millions of dollars to the people who are on the run. And he's serving them donuts and coffee and, you know, happily saying, of course, please come. There's more money in my trusts than there are waves in the ocean. And each day he survives, he's getting stronger. And it looks like he's going to pull it out. And each time the post thinks they have him, Ponzi slides out and seems to survive. And the run subsides. And people want to invest more and more money with Ponzi. And then Richard Grosier sends his best reporter, Herb Baldwin, known as Baldy, up to Montreal because they got a tip that Ponzi had served time up there. And they expose him as a guy who had done time for a quote-unquote bank fraud, this bad check that I mentioned to you about a half hour ago. And suddenly, all the hope, all the feeling that Ponzi was on the level starts to drain away with this story. And that's where I'll stop. Can't tell you the ending. But I'm happy to answer any questions. And I do hope that on your way out, you just look over the words, the Niles building, are still embedded in that building. That first picture I showed you of Ponzi, and in fact that one as well, which is taken from the other picture from that first slide of Ponzi, was taken right over there. You can see the yellow brick of the Niles building right behind him. Yes?
Hold on just a second. I'm going to ask everyone to use the microphone just because we're filming. Thanks.
I did read the book, and I found it absolutely fascinating because I was not around in the 20s, but my father was, and we had a lot of stories. In putting the book together, what were the biggest hurdles that you had to overcome, whether research or whatever?
Thank you, first of all. The biggest hurdles was that, just as you described, that I had no firsthand sources. I'm a journalist by training. My normal mode of operation is let me talk to everybody I can who witnessed it, who knew him, who had experienced this. So everything had to be secondhand sources. And then to build a narrative out of secondhand sources, you've got to get a truckload of work done because just to pull out one simple fact, like some of the facts that I told you about the people in the street or what was in his pockets at various times can take sometimes weeks of work. So it was a matter of the secondhand sourcing of everything. But I had the good fortune of, the Boston Public Library has one of the best newspaper collections in the country, and once Ponzi was being written about, I had access to that. I also had access to the Boston Globe archives, which had some great things in it. And finally, Ponzi's unpublished autobiography. Now, of course, because he was prone to exaggeration, every quote-unquote fact in his autobiography needed thorough checking, but it was a great roadmap. Thank you.
You mentioned that his idea was to buy the coupons and
yes.
then come back here. How had he figured out, how is he going to convert them to cash? Didn't he just get stamps over here?
Can
you sell stamps?
It's a great question. That was one of the conundrums that he faced, that what he thought, though, is if he turned them into stamps, he knew he could turn them into stamps here. He thought because he would have so many of these stamps, he could sell them to businesses at a discount that use stamps. If a business had a mail office and they were buying stamps at 5 cents, even if he sold them to a business at 4 cents each, he'd give up a little bit of his profit, but he would still be making 400 or 500% on his money. So that was one of his possible ways of doing it. But again, it was so implausible. Just those first investors from that January slide I showed you, the first 17 investors, I calculated he would have needed a stack of IRCs, of these IRCs, 21 feet high, just to satisfy the return on investment for those first 17 investments. So once he got to thousands or millions of dollars really involved, he would have needed a fleet of Titanic ships filled with these things to even approach it. Any other questions? Yes.
Did you say he wrote an autobiography and it was not published?
Yes.
Why wasn't it published?
Well, by the time he was in a position to I don't want to give too much away, but by the time he was in a position to write it, his name was Mudd. And people were not so much interested in what he had to say. Any trust that they had, most of the feelings toward him at the period in his life in the 40s, late 30s and 40s, after this had all come and gone, was negative. So no publisher wanted to publish it.
If I can ask a follow-on question to that, without getting into what might be proprietary, can you tell us where you found the unpublished biography?
Yes, I found it in the Library of Congress. And after finding it, it's off copyright. And so a guy in Florida, actually named Mark Mathosian, sort of self-published it. And I think you can actually buy it these days. I don't know where he sells it, but he sort of made it available because it's now it's public domain.
I arrived late, so you may have answered this already, but how did you come about this? What motivated you?
As a banking reporter in Boston, I decided, when I heard that Ponzi had operated here, I said, it's embarrassing that there's never been a great, or I hope, I don't know if I've done it, but a real good nonfiction account of this guy who's part of the lexicon. So I always knew that this was a book I wanted to write. Well, thank you very much for coming. I really appreciate it. Oh, one last thing. When you walk by 27 School Street, if you do, look up to the windows on the second floor. That's where Ponzi's office was. It's now occupied, so you can't go in, but what's interesting is the current tenant is a money manager.
Thank you to Mr. Zuckoff, and thank you all for coming.